Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 70 of season 5 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. Mm-hmm. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today to finish off this week is John from the Dirty Harry Minute. Welcome back, John.
Thank you for having me again.
Yeah, well, we've made it through the week. We've made it to Friday.
Oh yeah.
So that's always fun. That always works well.
Fri-yay.
Yippee Friday. Maybe. I don't know.
Good one.
Maybe not. Okay. All right. So episode 70 begins with Trudeau giving an uncertain response and ends with the FM1 pilot arguing with the tower. So we basically ended things yesterday with the bad guys finding out that, you know, FM1 is coming closer. He warns the tower, and then Barnes looks over at Trudeau and says, well, what are we going to do? And Trudeau starts this minute, actually, by saying, obey. You know, he doesn't look as if he's not really sure what he wants to do, but he realizes that they don't really have much of a choice here. You know, even though Trudeau knows that they've broken the code, despite the fact that, you know, they don't know that the bad guys don't know that they've found a way to break the code, you know, because of the fact that they're able to use the what's called it? They're able to use, you know, the outer marker beacon, you know, to talk to all the planes and tell them what they need to do. You know, so. Yeah, he's not really sure what it's going to do. And then the rest of this minute is going to basically be taking place on this FM1, Foreign Military One. And, you know, they give us a shot of the pilot and co-pilot of this plane, who we saw earlier in the movie. And basically we hear Stewart on the radio pretending to be the tower, where he says, Dulles Tower to Foxtrot Michael 1. Dulles Tower to Foxtrot Michael 1. This is Foxtrot Michael 1, Dulles. We read you. Over. Foxtrot Michael 1, you are to come in on runway 15. Repeat, 15. So let's actually talk a little bit about the codes that they use here. Okay, the idea of calling it Foxtrot Michael 1. Do you know where that idea comes from, basically? Or do you know what that's even called?
The answer to that question, last question, is no. I suppose they needed, like, when you repeat any name over, you know, the phone or in the army over radio, just to clarify what you mean, like A for Alpha, B for Barry, just to define the definition of what that letter is, because it's all good saying A. It's like, what do you mean, B, E, A, just to clarify? I suppose it's just been around for hundreds of years in telephony? Hasn't it? You tell me. How old is it?
Okay, so it's known as the International Radio Telephony Spelling Alphabet. Okay, and nowadays it's actually known as the
spelling
NATO
alphabet.
It's known as the NATO phonetic alphabet, and it uses a set of clear code words for communicating letters of the Roman alphabet. All right. Sometimes it's it has a whole bunch of different names, but the bottom line is that, you know, we have these 26 different terms that are used in order to make sure that when you're talking to somebody, they know what letter you're talking about. Because, for instance, you know, certain letters sound very similar, and if if it's a garbled message or the line isn't as clear as you would like it to be, it's very possible that they won't completely understand what you're saying. You know, an M and an N sound very similar, and D and P and B sound very similar, yeah. So it just makes sense to use terms that are much more easily identifiable, okay? But we're actually going to go even further back, because before we had the NATO version of it, which that actually was, it has been used since 1956, okay? Which we'll get to that list in a second as to what's mm-hmm. there. But beforehand, a number of different military armies used different codes. like the British had their codes, and then the Americans had their codes. So like during World War II, the Americans had a specific set of codes that were used over the course of the, you know, over the course of the war. Like if you, I don't know, have you ever seen like Saving Private Ryan or Band of Brothers or a whole bunch of other, you know, World War II type movies? Have you seen any of those?
Oh yeah, of course.
Okay. Yeah, do you remember in Band of Brothers? Anyway. Okay. So Private Ryan. So in Private Ryan, do you remember any of the various company names that they would use? Because you'd have like Company A, Company B, Company C, but they used names for it. Right? Are you familiar with any of those?
Company Bravo. Company Bravo, Charlie, or something. Or is that you mean?
Okay. So, well, that's the thing.
I can't remember any of the nicknames.
Well, what you're saying, the ones that are now used, you know, for NATO Army ones, the U.S. Army ones, so A was Able. So they you know, a lot of times you'll have them say Able Company. B was Baker. C is Charlie. D is Dog. E is Easy. You know, Easy Company. F is Fox. G is George. H is How. H-O-W. I is Item. J is Jig. K is King. L is Love. M is Mike. N is Nan. O is Oboe. I don't know why. P is Peter. Q is Queen. R is Roger. S is Sail or Sugar. T is Tear, T-A-R-E. U is Uncle. V is Victor. W is William. X is X-ray. Y is Yoke. And Z is Zebra. Okay. But the ones that they now use instead, so, you know, you have Alpha instead of Abel, Bravo instead of Baker, and then Charlie is the same, Delta instead of Dog, Echo instead of Easy, Foxtrot instead of Fox, Golf instead of George, Hotel instead of How, India instead of Item, Juliet instead of Jig, Kilo instead of King, Lima instead of Love, Mike stays the same, November instead of Nan, Oscar instead of Oboe, which Oscar sounds much better, Papa instead of Peter, Quebec instead of Queen, Romeo instead of Roger, Sierra instead of Sail, Tango instead of Tear, Uniform instead of Uncle, Victor stays the same, Whiskey instead of William, X-ray stays the same, Yankee instead of Yoke, and then Zulu instead of Zebra. So it's very strange because, you know, on the one hand, I like the old versions of it, but I do like the new ones also. So, you know, I guess it all depends if you're watching something from World War II or afterwards. But so the whole idea basically is to help make things, you know, sound when you're spelling something out for it to sound much, much better. So, you know, if the plane in this case is FM, so it's foreign military one. Okay, so if they had used the World War II ones, so then they would call it Fox Michael. But here they call it Foxtrot Michael. So, yeah. No, I just thought it was very interesting, the fact that, you know, the way that this evolved over the years, you know, in order to be able to, I mean, and it makes sense. Because if you're trying to explain something to somebody, instead of saying a letter, it's much easier just to talk about the entire, you know, the use a word. Which is one of the reasons why they used to do that for phone numbers also. A lot of times you'll see in old movies, you know, people will say either KL5 something, or sometimes they'll actually use a word. You know, when they're trying to reach some sort of extension, they'll use a word that uses two of the you know, the first two letters in order to figure out, you know, where what it is. And I think they would say Klondike 5-7 or something like that. You know, Klondike is KL, which... Yeah. On a phone is K and L are both fives, so it would be 555 anyway.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about the fact a few weeks ago about where that comes from, the whole idea of 555 numbers and stuff like that. So basically, then the shot changes and we're in the back of the plane and we see someone struggling. And if you were paying attention, this is actually the guard who was guarding Esperanza a few weeks ago. Esperanza has once again, you know, used his charisma to get him to come closer, to perhaps light up a cigar for him or something like that. And he takes advantage of it and starts strangling the guy and ends up killing him. And as he's killing him, we actually hear the snap of his neck. You know, the sound is there, you know, by the way that they do it. But, you know, Esperanza, it doesn't look like it's that difficult for him to deal with this, to, you know, kill this soldier who theoretically he's supposed to be, you know, working with and stuff like that. And the music changes at that moment also. We get very suspenseful music as this is all going on. So I like the way that they do that too.
Do you like the sort of medium to extreme close up of the belt and everything?
Extreme close up to see that he has a U.S. military holster?
I wasn't even thinking about that, but yeah, interesting.
You know, again, it's U.S. funded. They're U.S. funded military, so you know, the fact that we can see that his holster says U.S. on it. You know, that already says a lot about, you know, that this was something that the U.S. was in favor of until they decided one day that they were no longer in favor of it.
Yeah.
So, I like that little touch of showing that, you know. And then we go back to John and our good friend Marvin. They continue their conversation, and Marvin says, "I found it on the floor by the coat next to the luggage belt." What the hell are you so excited about that for? And John goes, "The code's still punched into this one. You like it, huh? How about you give me $20 for it? How about I let you live?" And then Marvin looks over him and goes, "Man knows how to bargain."
Man knows how to bargain. I'm Jack Nicholson here. But yeah. yeah, a bit harsh, isn't it?
Yes.
Judge the room, McLean, a bit over the top.
Yeah, I don't know if we really needed this whole scene. I mean, it again, for him saying where it came from makes sense. For them to get into a little bit of an argument about who's, you know, about whether he should be paying for it or not, I don't know. I'm a little confused about that. Don't know. You know, I'm on the fence as to whether that is really necessary or not, you know, for him to do that. And then we go back to the plane. Well, first of all, before we go back to the plane. So, you know, what this establishes is that this coat either belonged to Miller or to Cochran. Okay, but if he found it, why would it have a bullet hole in it? Because they would have taken it off beforehand. It wasn't that they took it off. Actually, you know what? I think Cochran takes off his jacket right before, you know, when they're in the middle of the fight. But I don't think he gets shot before then. So that's the strange thing.
Yeah, I'm just rewinding. I'm just playing back the minute. So what's the bullet hole thing? Does someone comment on that, or we see it?
No, you did. The fact that there's a bullet hole in the jacket.
Oh, yes. Sorry, the coat. Yeah, the jacket. Yeah. Yeah, because you can see his hand go through it in the previous minute. Yeah. I thought you were talking about the walkie. Sorry about that.
No. I was talking about the jacket. Yeah, so but when we see John back in the luggage area, There's nothing here to show that you know that he shot them beforehand.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I mean, when John's looking around and then he sees them, and he then says something about who he is. Actually, John is carrying a coat at that point. Could it be that this is John's coat?
Well, what does the script say? I mean,
The script doesn't say the script doesn't say where it is. Okay, when John gets shot at, so he drops his jacket that he was wearing. So it's very possible that this was John's jacket, because I don't see, when rewatching those minutes, I don't see either Miller or Cochran taking off their jackets.
No.
Yeah, this was John's jacket, which makes sense that then earlier in the week when John says to him, "You know, I didn't like it much back when I had it," or something to that. It shows that really was John's jacket. But then why would John say next week that he's that he can get him a lining for the jacket. You know, because it means, does that mean that that lining is very standard?
And why doesn't he mention it here to Marvin? Or it could be the brothers, yeah.
Why doesn't he mention what, that it's his jacket?
Yeah. Well, why is this?
Well, again, anyway? He made a comment earlier this week, you know, about the fact that it's possible that you know, it can be interpreted that it is John's.
Yeah.
What does he say? This was back on Monday. No, Tuesday. Tuesday, when Marvin said, "You interested in a nice coat?" And then John says, "No, it never looked good on me anyway."
Ah, right.
Completely forgot. So yeah, that actually now makes sense.
Yep.
So you know, it was definitely once again, Chekhov's coat.
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember if we. I think we did see the radio, you know, go flying at some point. So therefore, you know, it makes sense that Marvin would find both of those items in the same area. You know, it's not that far-fetched to think that.
Once again, So once again, Carmine really didn't investigate or put up police tape or really do any sort of forensic like preservation of the crime scene, did he? If Marvin,
well, he hasn't had a chance because in the interim there's a new crime scene.
Yeah, that's right.
That has four dead bodies instead of just one.
This man's just been killed. His head's been crushed. But yeah, there's two more murders, so let's completely just not worry about that first murder. Anyway,
that's right. Yeah. That's right. That makes sense. Then we go back to the plane. And the pilot, it continues to argue with the tower by saying, "This is contrary to our instructions. We are to land on runway 10, where we are to be met," and then he gets cut off. So you'd think that it wouldn't make a difference to the pilot because, you know, you're flying somewhere and they tell you, okay, the assumption is that you're going to land on runway 10. That's fine. But, okay, you get to the airport, and now there's too much snow. That runway is too icy. There's a plane stuck on that runway, so we want you to land on a different runway. You know, the argument that the pilot gives here isn't very convincing.
No.
You know, because why would you get instructions saying, okay, you're only to land on runway 10? If anyone tells you different, don't believe them. So I don't know. I'm a little skeptical about that one.
Well,
not really sure.
I mean, the major plot device, if this general is so important, why are they letting a foreign military force deliver him? And two, why are they delivering him?
I think part of the issue here is that, okay, this is Valverde has overthrown its previous dictator, and they're now delivering, you know, the new government in Valverde are the people that are now delivering it.
Yeah, I think in reality, America would say, no, look, we'll take carriage of this, you know. We're not going to let the new democratic government in Afghanistan fly Osama bin Laden back to the States. Not that I'm equating the two, but I'm just saying I think America would intervene and go, nah, look, that's fine. You're a new government. Okay, we trust you, sort of. But please let us handle this. We'll send a Hercules in there and take him. And we're not going to fly him back to bloody John Kennedy Airport. We're gonna take him to the Pentagon Airport or whatever. Anyway, we need to have a
movie. Or Gitmo.
You're right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And that's pretty much how this minute ends. You know, to find out what happens with it, we'll have to speak to, you know, we'll have to wait until Monday to find out what continues to happen. But what's great here is that you can see in the background as the pilot is talking, you see Esperanza slowly entering the cockpit very silently.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, we already know that he just killed, you know, the guy who was guarding him. So something nefarious is happening. But you see him show up with a gun in his hand walking into the cockpit. And I got to say, it's a good cliffhanger to keep people over the weekend by the way that they do that.
Oh, yeah, very. Couldn't have planned it better.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so the script is pretty much the same. It has a few little minor discrepancies where basically, you know, Stewart tells him to, you know, to come to runway 15. And then it says the camera is in the rear cabin just in time to see Esperanza strangle the nice young corporal with the chain from his handcuffs. He lets the body drop nice and soft so it doesn't make a sound. Taking the handcuff key from the body, he frees himself. And then it goes back to John and Marvin and says, McLean is examining the scrambler, excited. The code still punch. Where'd you get this? Came with the code. Over near the luggage belts. Look like one of them Japanese radios. Can't hold a candle to a nice zenith, if you ask me. You like it, huh? How about $20? And then McLean goes, how about I let you live? Marvin hands it over and says, man knows how to bargain. And then the rest of it is still the same. So, yeah. So, John, did you have anything else you want to say about, you know, what we've talked about this week or perhaps something about the movie in general?
Well, what you've just mentioned, that bit in the script. So we supposed to – Marvin's a vet, I guess. Do you reckon a World War II vet if he's
– Oh, that we know. Oh. We know he is, because later on he'll say – he says just like Iwo Jima. You know, he will have that phrase that he barks out. I believe it's – probably one of the last scenes in the movie. I think it was after John shoots with the blanks. I think that's where he goes, just like you with Jamma.
Okay.
Even though Tom Bauer was not old enough to fought in Iwo Jima, but that's a separate issue. We'll get there when we get there.
And obviously a bit of a part of this movie talks about John hating technology, right? And then you've got someone, the context of someone hating technology because it, you know, it comes from a form of foe. So yeah, there's a bit of a political commentary there, I guess, in a way. I mean, I was surprised when I watched this movie. Like, I always thought this movie was a bit of a lesser action movie, and then when I watched it, I thought it's pretty good. And I don't know if a lot of that for me is just because I pretty much love everything I've seen Bruce Willis in, like he's a commanding performer. And I always thought, oh, the best thing about Die Hard is the claustrophobia of it, about, you know, one location. Mm-hmm. And this movie's all over the place. You know, in theory, he's at the church, he's in the air, he's on a plane, he's in a plane, he's in a helicopter, he's on the wing of a plane. So that didn't detract at all. So I quite really enjoyed the opportunity to rewatch it. And yeah, it's a nice little artifact, I guess. Like, I mean, action films, I suppose, have been around for 10 years at this sort of time. Sequels were still, apart from Rambo and stuff, sort of action sequels were a bit of a novelty. And when I was rewatching it, you know, that bit where he's complaining about Glocks, you know, Glocks are these new guns you haven't heard of, they don't turn up on x-rays, and when they're still explaining things like that to the audience, you think, oh yeah, it's sort of towards the beginning of action movies and action tropes. And so mm-hmm. yeah, and you know, there's that bit later when, you know, the pinko journalist, what's her name, she's reporting on the crash or whatever.
Dan Coleman.
Yeah, and you know what she says, and she goes, now we're going to cut to a break. And it's like, now it would be a 24 news cycle thing. You know what I mean? There are some parts of it where it's sort of quaint in a way, because the audiences aren't really totally to speed with what we expect from sequels and action films as well. Obviously, it's got the commentary about the media and everything. But basically, yeah, it's a lot of set pieces, great action, I'd say. There's enough twists in the end. And yeah. Thanks for letting me come and an excuse for me to watch it again.
All right, great. But you know, we're not done yet. We still have Friday segment to do. So every Friday, we have a segment called Where Are They Up To This Weekend?
Oh.
Where I have a little fun with my guests and try to see how good their memory is about some of the movies that they deem as part of their favorites. So, you know, John, I know you did Dirty Harry, minute by minute. So what do you think is going on in Dirty Harry at the 70-minute mark?
This I know. So around 60, they're at Mount Davidson Cross. I want to say, is it in Kezar Stadium when Harry's torturing Scorpio? And where's the girl? I have the right to a lawyer. Is it around there?
Yeah, that is exactly where it is. That is great. Wow. Good job on that one. All right. But now we're going to see how well you know the other movies in the Dirty Harry franchise.
Oh, okay. This is fun. I like this.
Okay, so... All right, so moving along, we're going to go to Magnum Force. Mm-hmm. What is happening in Magnum Force at the 70-minute mark?
This will be a lot harder. I will explain to the people listening that Dirty Harry is a tight 100 minutes. So good. No fat on that bone. Magnum, which is a great movie, is longer. It's like almost about 2 hours. So 70 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, it's even over. It's over. Yeah. It's over 2 hours. It's 2 hours and 2 minutes.
Okay. Is it in the scene where one of the villains in the high-rise apartment is doing cocaine with his girlfriend and the other man, and the body falls down? Is it there, the stakeout?
No. It's a scene in the airport.
The airport. Which one? Like when they're farewelling the dead body of Charlie McCoy? Or is
when you have McCoy. You have Dirty Harry talking to the woman, talking to the woman as she's about to, she wants to get on the plane, and then bringing her together with the, you know, her three children.
Oh yes, no, I was right then. Like Charlie McCoy's body, I don't know if you see it, but it's going onto the plane, and she's there, sort of Harry's consoling her, and David Soul's there with his glasses, going, yeah, I think that's the right scene, yeah. It's like a minute scene.
Yes.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Got that.
But you said it was in the high rise.
Oh, yes. I got it wrong. But yeah, I identified what the airport was. Yes.
Right. No. Okay. No. That's good. I still give you credit. You're close. That's still great. All right. Moving along to The Enforcer. What is happening at the 70-minute mark of The Enforcer?
70? Okay.
70. Yep.
So this movie is around 95 minutes or something long in duration. So they're not.
It's 96. Yep. Yes, you're correct.
Not on Alcatraz. I want to say, is it in the scene where Harry puts on a baseball cap and goes to the sex parlor to try and get some information, and he's with a blow up doll? Is it around there?
No. It's a part where there's a car that's driving around and someone gets shot in the car right before it, they're chasing the car, and then, you know, they have an explosion that happens.
Oh, yes. And they get the mayor out of the car, right? The limousine?
That's right.
After the bazooka.
That's right.
Damn. Nice.
Yeah.
Damn.
All right. Is that three down, two to go?
Mm-hmm. I've got to make.
All right. So now we're going to be at sudden impact. What's going on in sudden impact at the 70-minute mark?
70-minute mark. This movie has a lot of scenes and setups, and it's around 2 hours as well, isn't it? Something like that.
Yes. It's a little bit over 2 hours.
I wonder if Harry has
even... Sorry, it's an hour and 57 minutes.
I wonder if Harry has even left San Francisco for San Paolo. I'm going to say it is, and is it where he bumps into Sandra Locke? She's riding her bike, and they're at a marina, and we get introduced to his dog, Meathead. Is it around there?
Dirty Harry actually shows up at the fish store and gets into a fight in the bathroom.
Yeah, with the wife of one of the victims.
The Cleaver.
Yeah, Cleaver.
Yes.
Yeah. Damn. Yeah. Now a bit further on in the movie than I thought, but yeah.
All right, and the final one, the Deadpool. What is going on at the 70-minute mark?
Oh, is this during the miniature car chase? And is the car underneath the Oldsmobile about to blow up Harry and his partner,
Elmer? Oh, you got it. You bookended it. You got the first and fifth one perfect. And then the others, you were a little bit off, but you were still good.
And I dislike Deadpool, but two out of five is pretty piss poor, isn't it? But I'm glad I got Dirty Harry right. Yeah.
Well, at least you got the Dirty Harry one right, which is the important one for you.
That was fun.
Yeah. All right, good. I'm glad that you enjoyed that. You're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you for that. Mm. So, John, for one last time this week, do you want to tell people where they can find you?
Please, all you need to do is go onto Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or whatever and just search Dirty Harry Minute. Put that into your Google search bar, or you could just go to the source, dirtyharryminute.com, and all our episodes are there, and our contact details are there too at the website. So dirtyharryminute.com.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, or you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So John, thank you very much for joining me from Down Under this week.
You're welcome.
I'm glad that you were able to come back this season. It was a lot of fun. I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay, mother.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages